Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, New York Times bestselling author and renowned linguist Deborah Tannen joins us to discuss her new book, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. In her book, Deborah Tannen examines the role of talk in women's friendships. Her research included discussions with girls and women ranging from age 9 to 97. From these conversations, Deborah Tannen analyzes how patterns of communication and miscommunication can impact female friendships. In You're the Only One I Can Tell, Deborah discusses how women and girls use language to both connect and compete. And she also evaluates how social media is changing the way women relate. Deborah Tannen is a professor of linguistics at Georgetown University and the author of numerous books, including You Just Don't Understand, Men and Women in Conversation, a New York Times bestseller for nearly 4 years. I'm happy to welcome Deborah Tannen to City Visions.
Hi, nice to be here.
Great to have you. And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website and tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Deborah Tannen, how did you decide to write about women's friendships after you've written about all sorts of other types of interactions between human beings?
Well, the last book that I wrote was about sisters, and the one before that was mothers and daughters. So friends are the third really significant all-female friendship, all-female relationship that plays such a large role in so many women's lives. And it's one that I think hasn't been written about quite as much as those others. For many women and girls, their female friends, their best friends, their circle of friends can be the most important force in their lives.
And then specifically, why focus on friendship between women as opposed to friendship between men?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm a linguist. My area of expertise is talk. And going back to the book You Just Don't Understand that I wrote about women and men, and as soon as I say women and men, it's really important to emphasize not all women and men are alike. Nothing that I say will be true of all women or all men. We're talking about tendencies and percentages, so I want to say that right up front. So right back there, when I wrote You Just Don't Understand, both my own research and research that anthropologists and psychologists had done on kids, just, you know, kids at play, they found very early on that girls tended to spend a lot of time talking and that boys often spent more time in activities. Now, obviously, girls do lots of activities and boys talk, but back then, I almost like a mantra found myself frequently saying, for girls and women, your best friend is the one you tell everything to. For boys and men, the best friend is one you do everything with. And it's that role of talk in close relationships among women that really makes it so appropriate for the kind of work that I do. I'd like to tell just a short anecdote that kind of captures that difference. Someone that I was talking to was telling me about a conversation that she had with her son. Her son had recently graduated from college, was now living in a distant city. Actually, it was San Francisco. And she had a conversation that went something like this. She asked about a particular friend of his that she knew quite well and asked if he had talked to him lately. And her son said, yeah, I talked to him yesterday. And she said, well, how's he doing? And he said, I don't know. Well, how's his work? I don't know. How's his girlfriend? Don't know. Didn't you just talk to him? Yeah, I talked to him yesterday. Well, what did you talk about? Football. Did you only talk about football? No. Soccer, too. That contrast would be very unlikely. That kind of conversation would be very unlikely among two close women friends. In fact, of the people that I interviewed, many told me a good friend has to know what's going on in your life. It could almost be a definition of a friend. She knows what's going on in my life. And the fact that the conversations were so different kind of explains another kind of conversation that is common. And I actually heard very recently an account like this from a guy, but it's one that I've heard many times before. He said that he and his wife were good friends with another couple, and he often spent time with the husband. His wife often spent time with the wife. And one evening, his wife said to him, "Isn't that terrible that they're getting divorced?" And he was stunned. He had played tennis with the husband every week for months, and he said the subject of his marriage never came up. So it's the difference in what women and men tend to talk about, and again, I can't emphasize this enough, it's not that no man would ever tell his friend about his troubles in his marriage, but the assumption, the expectation that you're going to talk about what's going on in your life, you're going to talk about personal things, is a bigger part of many women's friendships than it is of any men's. Being a linguist who studies talk, I, of course, found that fascinating.
So does the preponderance of talk in women's friendships in general say more about the intimacy between women in platonic relationships compared to men in platonic relationships, or can you not make that distinction?
I wouldn't. I think people can feel quite intimate doing things together, just as they can talking. I guess I would think of it as a different way of creating intimacy. And I should say there are many women, or certainly times in many of our lives, that all that talk can be a burden. And when I think of a woman who commented that when she was going through her divorce, and it was a very difficult one, she avoided her women friends because of all that. She didn't want all that talk. And she commented that what she found really comforting was spending time with a man that she knew, and she said he was going through a divorce too. They would get together. They knew they were both going through the same thing, and that created a kind of closeness, but they didn't talk about it. They just rode their bikes until they were exhausted. So to me, that is a kind of intimacy, just a different kind.
So you're just saying that talk happens to be the currency of intimacy when it comes to women more so than between men.
It is more often. And I'll mention a study that was done by Eleanor Maccoby, who was a professor at Stanford. And this is very striking because she's one of the leading researchers on sex differences among kids. And she had written a book, an early book that was very very celebrated, in which she surveyed the findings of many studies, and she and her co-author concluded that there were really no significant sex differences, except that boys did tend to be more aggressive. A number of years later, she and her co-author decided to actually look at kids interacting, and they took, I think it was something like 48 pairs of unacquainted kids, little ones, 33 months old, about 2.5 years. And they dressed alike, and they didn't use names, and so you couldn't really tell whether they were male or female just by looking at them. And there were three conditions. So in some cases, it was two boys, in some it was two girls, in some it was one of each sex. And they didn't know each other. They're just unacquainted kids. They found that when the kids were the same sex, they played together much more. So the boys, twice as much time was spent playing, but what they did was run around, running, chasing. And when it was two girls, even more than twice as much time was spent playing and talking. And these are just little kids, right? Two and a half years old. And they said that it really wasn't the parents' influence, because parents tended to, at that age, put kids together because they were relatives or they were neighbors or they were in the same vicinity. So it didn't seem to be that.
So what conditions women or girls, in the example you just gave, to relate through talk as opposed to boys, generally speaking, relating through activities?
Yeah, I have to say, I observe human behavior and describe what I see. So I don't really have a basis to know why that happens. But it does start early. And certainly once we're growing up among girls or among boys, you kind of pick up that that's the expectation. And we all know there are girls and boys who prefer to play with kids of the other sex. You know, there may be an issue of sexual orientation, but maybe not, just what they're comfortable with. Sometimes it's a matter of having a lot of siblings of the other sex. But the tendency is for girls to pick up that this is how girls' friendships are maintained. And then as adults, that feeling that you're not alone in the world because somebody cares about what's going on. I'll mention another conversation, typical conversation that I wrote about in You Just Didn't Understand that I think is kind of significant here. There's a kind of talk we call troubles talk. So that's spending a lot of time just talking about things that are bothering you. And it's more common among women than men, and so it leads to this pretty frequent conversation where a woman might start telling a man that she's close to about some problem, and he makes a suggestion about how to fix the problem, and she's frustrated. That isn't what, you know, I wasn't looking for a solution, and he's frustrated, so his feeling might be something like, why do you want to talk about it if you don't want to do anything about it? And at the time that I wrote that book, and it was picked up because I think it's a conversation that many people have experienced, it's almost become like a truism in our culture. The interpretation was she didn't want a solution, she just wanted to talk about it. I don't think that's true, and I wouldn't put it that way now. What I think is that she didn't want the solution right off the bat. So how might the conversation go if it were with a woman friend or sibling? Then you might get, so tell me what happened. Well, why did he say that? Well, then what did you say? And then how did you feel when he said that? And how did he react when you said that? And after asking all these questions, you get the information that you need to know what advice to give. And furthermore, just having the conversation, asking those questions, is a show of caring and of closeness. I often talk about message and meta-message. So the message is the meaning of the words. The meta-message is what it says about the relationship that you say these words in this way at this time. So there's a meta-message of caring and of closeness that's communicated by asking the questions. So that's what I think is the misfire in that conversation that I described
between men and
at the
women.
Beginning. Yeah. Right. It isn't that she didn't want a solution. It's that saying the solution right away shuts down the conversation.
She wanted validation first, perhaps.
The way I would put it is she wanted to start a conversation like that because the conversation itself is a comforting and satisfying thing. Having that conversation is what says, we care about each other. You care enough to spend this time listening to me and asking me. I care enough to tell you. And you get that meta message of connection from having the conversation.
So the conversation is in and of itself worthy. It has worth and value.
Right.
Not just sort of where it gets you, so
exactly.
to speak. You spend a lot of time in your book talking about how these conversations, as much as women are talking, it's not without a lot of, twists and turns. I would say choreography, perhaps, and choreography that might be hidden from the women engaged in the conversation. Can you help break it down a little bit more, how you understand sort of broad categories of ways that women converse, and what are the sort of interesting observations and potential pitfalls of those ways of communicating?
Yeah. So I just, as I mentioned, some of what I said now is part of that. So troubles talk would be a common kind of conversation that's common among women. And then there are pitfalls. So the fact that not everybody wants to have that kind of conversation all the time would be one. Another pitfall that comes with talking about something very personal is that there's always a risk that a person might repeat it. Somebody put it this way that I kind of liked, someone I interviewed said, when I tell somebody something personal, it's like saying, here's a little piece of me. This means I like you. Well, once they've got a piece of you, there's a question of what they're going to do with it. And when women told me that they there were actually a few women who said to me, I don't have women friends, I don't trust women. It was often gossip that they were talking about, that they didn't trust women not to repeat their secrets. Well, I don't, and actually quite a few said that they, one thing they really value about men friends is men don't repeat their secrets. I don't think it's that men are inherently more trustworthy than women, but that they have less to gain by repeating. So among girls and women, the tendency is for closeness to be kind of the goal, like the pot of gold at the end of the relationship rainbow. Closeness is valued. People said, when people told me a friend was a close friend, it was a good thing. People sometimes said, I wish we were closer. They rarely said, I wish we weren't so close. Well, how do you create that closeness, and how do you let others know that you're close? Well, by knowing their secrets. So girls and women can be quite competitive about who knows what and who knows first. So if you have a group of friends and one of them knows something about another that that person hasn't told you, there can be a feeling of hurt. And girls can be quite competitive in wanting to kind of show off that they're close to someone in the group or to a popular girl. And the way they can show that is by saying, you know, she told me this. I know this about her that you don't know. So that can be a pitfall of those kinds of
I imagine it's a pitfall for both parties, or both parties to the conversation, right? Because for the person who's made themselves vulnerable, their secret gets disclosed to others and they're exposed, and perhaps there are negative consequences because of that. But then, of course, for the discloser, that could backfire and sort of and cause friction or inject difference and distance into the friendship.
Well, yeah, it's complicated. I have a student who's from Kazakhstan. And she interviewed women in a small village in Kazakhstan and translated some of those interviews for me. And she quoted a woman in, again, a small village in Kazakhstan, and she put it so beautifully. She said something like, if you can tell somebody about your troubles, they step back and they seem smaller and the days seem sunnier. But later in the interview, she said she really didn't tell her troubles to anybody, because it was a small village and you had to be really careful about who would repeat things. And I don't want to make it sound like this is a huge problem in everybody's life. I mean, yeah, we all have issues where occasionally something will be repeated that we didn't want. I think for the most part, women that I talked to told me how much they treasured close friends that they could talk to. One woman said, you know, a friend is somebody that I can call up when something's bothering me. And she'll help me think through it. And for the most part, that was what I heard. But yeah, I did sometimes hear people being hurt, either because something was repeated or because something wasn't told. Someone told me about a friend who she thought was a good friend, and they had traveled together. She had helped the friend out in various ways. And then one day the friend announced that she was getting a divorce, leaving her husband, and kind of wanted this friend's approval, and the friend felt, well, you know, I kind of, she felt betrayed that all this was going on. I was telling you it was going on in my life, and you weren't telling me. So it's complicated, but for the most part, what I heard from women was how much they value that kind of talk.
And when women have these kinds of differences or these moments where the closeness is tested, or there is a revelation of a differential in the closeness, how are they able to work through those? Does talking, the fact that the propensity for talk, allow them the opportunity to also talk through conflict in a way that may be different between men?
That's a great question. I write a lot in this book and in every book I've written about conversational style. That is, we have our assumptions about the right way to have a conversation, and we think that everybody probably shares that, and we tend to think that you must have similar, it must work the same way for you. Well, a point of conversational style difference is the extent to which people value talking through problems. Some people do value that and feel, if I'm frustrated with you, I better tell you, then you can tell me why and we can talk about it and then we can get past it. For other people, that kind of talking through is very uncomfortable. They really don't want to do it. They would rather just let a little time go by, you'll get over it, you'll put it behind you, and you move on. And I heard this between sisters, and certainly heard it between friends. And it can be tricky, because if one feels we have to talk about it or we can't get past it, and the other feels talking about it is just going to make it worse and it's going to take longer to get past it if we talk about it. And it's true, sometimes when you talk about things, you can work them out, and sometimes it actually makes it worse because each one repeats their perspective, maybe trying to explain why what they did was right, which might entail why you were wrong, and doesn't always make it better. So, in so many things, there are different takes on it.
So even, you know, the stereotype, of course, out there is that, you know, women want to process and men really don't want to talk about their feelings, right? But you're saying there within relationships between women, among women, there can be varying degrees to which people want to process.
Yes, absolutely. And when I wrote about differences, that tendencies between women and men, they were all parameters that could vary by sex, or they could vary by region, by ethnicity, by class, by sexual orientation, by the kind of work that you do. So yeah, all of these, you know, if you think of an accountant married to a psychologist, if the psychologist were the guy and the accountant were the woman, maybe the positions would be reversed.
I want to get back to the cultural and socioeconomic differences in just a moment. But first, I'm going to reintroduce the program. In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the language of women's friendships with New York Times bestselling author and Georgetown linguist Deborah Tannen, whose latest book is You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. How has language impacted your relationships, whether it's with a woman or a man? But if you're a woman, with another woman specifically, tell us about how you've managed to dance the dance of talk between you and another woman. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, let's go back, Deborah Tannen, to this idea of cultural differences. So what kinds of similarities between women did you see, and what kinds of differences across cultural boundaries, socioeconomic boundaries? You mentioned sexual orientation. What did you see?
Yeah. I have a whole chapter on conversational style differences and many, many cultural influences here. A few quick examples. A woman who told a good friend that her mother was in the hospital, and she expected the friend to ask, how's your mother doing? And she didn't. So she confronted the friend that she was hurt by this, and the friend said, oh my goodness, in my family I was always taught you don't ask questions like that. If somebody wants to talk about it, they'll volunteer. Now, the woman who said that happened to be Vietnamese-American. And that didn't surprise me too much, because many Asian cultures tend to avoid topics more than maybe some Western cultures might. But this is something that can come up between any cultural differences. A woman who commented that her friends would never ask for anything, ask for a favor. And yet she felt that this friend was asking her for a favor. Well, that really seemed awful to her. I mean, and she's always asking me these favors. She never does any. And I said, well, do you ask her? No, I would never do that. That's terrible. In that case, it was a British woman and an American woman. Maybe that's the reason for the differences, maybe not. Directness and indirectness. A woman who, this is three people, so they'd all gone to the same college, and now they're out. Two of the women lived in the same town, and a guy who they knew from college was visiting one of them. And he said, gee, you know, how's so-and-so? Are you in touch with her? And she said, oh, yeah, I am. He said, gee, I'd like to see her. Okay, I'll call her. So she calls the friend, so-and-so's in town. He'd like to see you. Should I bring him over? Yeah, yeah, definitely bring him over. She thought everything was fine. The next day, her friend called and was livid. Why did you bring him over? I can't stand him. But you said it was fine. Well, you should have known from the way I said it that I didn't mean it. Now, this can seem almost absurd, and in fact, the person who, to whom this happened actually was, did think it was absurd. When we have these conversational style differences, we think our way is so obviously right. How could anyone expect me to know? But the truth is that we interpret things that other people say all the time. Just a quick example where this worked. Woman was, this is one of my students, I have them often observe their own interactions and describe them in papers that they write for class and analyze them in terms of the work we've been doing in class. So she was talking to her roommates. The roommates were talking about having a party Thursday night. She didn't think much of it. But Thursday comes around and she realizes she's going to be up all night writing a paper. What's she going to do? She could just say to the roommate, oh, nix that party. I have a paper to write. No, she just started a conversation. Hey, what do you think about doing tonight? And her friend said, roommate said, we were thinking about having a party. What are you doing? And she said, well, I'll be up all night writing a paper. And the friend said, oh, then we won't have a party. And she said, no, that's fine. And the friend said, no, we definitely won't have a party. And the student wrote, that time I didn't resist. Well, the first time she said it would be fine, what if the friend had taken her literally? And they had the party and the friend's upset, but you said it was fine. She knew that no, it's fine wasn't meant literally, and often we don't.
And so what you're saying there is that tone, delivery, perhaps body language that not necessarily reflected in the field notes that you describe, really gives context and cues.
Yes.
So say how interactions on social media, which are often devoid of those types of cues, although there's the emoticons and all, but how has that affected the way women communicate?
Yeah, we do know, people that have studied interactions online, that women tend to exchange more personal information, longer texts and other kinds of messages, and often have more kind of what we would call troubles talk, maybe, as well as making plans, which is what we all do using social media. But I think of social media as ratcheting up both the positive and the negative things about interaction. And you really see this with girls and women. So, for example, somebody that I was talking to, this is an older woman, was complaining about social media. And she said, all this stuff out there that nobody needs to know. I don't care what somebody had for dinner. Well, she was reacting to the habit. That's very common. Snapping pictures, snapping selfies, sending them to your friends or posting them. But I thought of something that another woman said in an interview. At one point in her interview, she said about a particular friend, she isn't that close a friend. I wouldn't tell her about my kids' problems. But then she said elsewhere in the interview about somebody else, she isn't that close a friend. I wouldn't tell her what I had for dinner. Now, at first, that seems absurd, but when you think about it, that end-of-day conversation with somebody you're close to, what did you do? What did you think? What did that make you say? What did that effect it have? And who did you go with? And what did you eat? So we do have these conversations with people we're close to. So it's almost like an extension of that end-of-day conversation. Only now you don't have to wait till the end of the day to tell the person what you've done. You snap a picture and you send it, and it's almost like they were with you. And that is the beauty of having that kind of friendship or relationship. You know that there's somebody you can tell about the little things that happen during the day. It makes you feel less alone as you go through that day. Well, now, for many of us, we really are not alone. We are in an open state of communication. Anyone can communicate to us at any moment, and we can communicate to them at any moment. And so it really is an extension of that end-of-day conversation throughout the day. But what's the downside? One of the real sore spots in many close relationships among women, and this was true for mothers and daughters, for sisters, and for friends, if they told me that they were hurt by something, it was often being left out. And this word FOMO, you know, F-O-M-O, fear of missing out. Well, maybe that's why we all check our phones all the time, because we don't want to miss out. You missed the party because you didn't check your phone in time. But there's something I call FOBLO, F-O-B-L-O, FOBLO, fear of being left out. And that means you missed the party because you weren't invited. There was always that risk that you're going to hear about things you weren't invited to. Or even just be told about things you could have gone to but you didn't, and you feel bad that you were left out. Well, with social media, you are constantly exposed to not just information, but pictures of situations where you were left out. People that you care about, and they're engaged in all kinds of activities, and you're not there. It's always hurtful to be told of that, but if you actually see it, it's even more hurtful, more poignant. And so that is a real downside, I think, of this, of the ubiquity of social media, that we're constantly seeing all the things everybody we love are doing, and we're not there. And it can be hurtful.
It sounds like you get much more of a window into your status very quickly. You can't leave it to the imagination, or you can't be blissfully ignorant when you find out you've been left out of something that others were in on.
And furthermore, it gives the impression of being a far more positive experience than it really was. A high school girl was telling me she was talking to a friend of hers, and the friend was going on about how terrible this party was, and she was so miserable, and she left right away. And then they hang up the phone, and she looks on Instagram, and there's a picture of that same girl at that party. And she said, if I hadn't just talked to her, I would have thought I missed the party of the year.
Well, it's interesting, because I'm not on Facebook, and I found out that two really good friends of mine were getting married because they posted it on Facebook before they told me. So it's an interesting, you know, how do people choose to also extricate themselves from certain types of communication?
Well, I can't resist asking you a question. So how did you feel about the fact that it was on Facebook before they told you?
Well, I was pretty upset.
yeah. And I think often people are aware of that and have to correct for it and try to remember to tell everybody that's going to want to know before they put it on there. But it's tough because there's an awful lot of people out there.
Right. And so the fact that people are sharing in such a broad way, in a broadcasting way, does that kind of dilute the intimacy between, or has the chance or the risk of diluting intimacy between friends, specifically women, if, you know, it's, you got to tell, you're telling everyone at the same time, and when you've left, and you're telling almost everyone, if you left someone out, whether it's intentional or unintentional, that's much more fraught with trouble?
Well, I see the risk as being more fraught, yeah, because there is a greater risk of people hearing that you didn't tell directly. I don't tend to share the concern. I know many people have that concern that young people are forgetting what it means to be friends. They have 1,000 friends on Facebook. They don't even know what it means to be friends. They forget how to talk to friends. That does not seem to be the case, at least with the young people that I have in my classes and that I know in my life. They know the difference between a Facebook friend and a close friend. It does complicate their lives. I do think it is a burden and a complication, but I don't think it means no intimacy. It just makes the managing of intimacy a little more difficult.
Again, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're in conversation with linguist and New York Times bestselling author Deborah Tannen, whose latest book is You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. Again, our phone lines are open for you with your questions and comments. How has social media impacted your relationships, and if so, how? And what makes a good friend? And what is the value of being able to talk to someone to share your troubles with? The number to dial to join our conversation, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So you've mentioned a couple of times the distinctions between family, sort of sibling, mother-daughter relationships. What's different about relationships between women who are not related to each other? And how is the talk between them either open up opportunities or close off opportunities for connection and intimacy?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't think I addressed it in exactly that way, but I'd like to think about it that way. It is definitely the case that many people told me they are closer to their friends than their sisters. So I heard things like, my friends are the sisters I was meant to have. My friends know things about me, my sisters don't, because my friends were there and my sisters were not. And then, of course, not everybody has sisters. I've heard a lot of different comments about that. One woman I know who did not have sisters told me that most of her friends also did not have sisters because she felt if they had sisters, she could never replace them, and their sisters were really their best friends. Somebody else told me when her husband died, the friends that came through the most were the ones who had sisters, and she felt that those friends of hers who didn't have sisters didn't really know how to come through in the same way. So there's a lot of ins and outs there, and I think many people's interpretations may not be true for everybody. Mm. But certainly some people feel that they can be more open with a friend than with a family member because they're less judgmental. On the other hand, they may not know the history in the same way. But there's one thing about friends that's different from family, and that is you choose them. One thing that I wrote quite a bit about is the painful situation of having a friendship just cut off. Sometimes the term used now is ghosting. Somebody just cuts you off and doesn't say why. It can happen in families too, and I definitely encountered it and wrote about it in families as well. But it seems more common among friends, and in a way, you could say that one of the great liberations of friendship is you can end it if you want to. You might cut a sister or a family member off, but they're still your sister or your family member. If you cut off a friend, well, you can really have nothing more to do with them. And it was very painful because these relationships can be just as meaningful. And I heard many stories of people being extremely hurt by a friendship ending that way. But that is a difference. Just the fact that when I asked people about their mothers and daughters and sisters, they always knew who those were. But when I asked about friends, there was a vast range of relationships that fell into that category of friends. Some could be someone that they knew since childhood, could be someone they just met, could be someone they never met, that they only communicate with online, but still feel very close to and feel that they're a friend. There are friends who you see every day. There are friends who you see rarely, but when you see them, it's like no time has passed. There are friends who, in fact, somebody said about a friend, well, I don't enjoy her company all that much, but it's beside the point. She's like family. So, yeah, it's you get a whole range.
So let's go to a couple of callers. Again, put the phone number out, 415-841-4134, if you want to join our conversation this evening with Deborah Tannen, author of the book, the new book, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships, 415-841-4134. Let's go first to Sarah from Castro Valley. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much. I wanted to thank Dr. Tannen so much for being a wonderful influence in my life. When I was 19, I read her book, You Just Don't Understand, with my then boyfriend, who's now my husband of 25 years. And we still use her book as a common language. If we have a problem, the other person will say, now, do you want me to solve this problem, or do you want me to tell you, I understand and I want to hear more about it? And it's made us much more thoughtful about how to communicate with each other and how to help each other. And it really doesn't feel foreign or fake at all for us to say, what kind of help do you need? What kind of communication? Because she helped us understand we're coming at it from two different vantage points. So thank you so much.
Let me thank you so much for saying that. It means so much. It's a reason to keep on writing when people tell me that it has helped them. So thank you.
And I'm really excited about your new book. I have three teenagers, and I'm a high school English teacher, and I can't wait to read the results with the social media. I often suggest men and women in conversation as a topic for students' research papers, and the students who have done that and used your work in the past have also found it really interesting and love to share their findings with their peers. And so now I have a new resource from you to recommend to them, which will be, you know, very important to how they communicate. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your call.
Thanks so much, Sarah, for your call. Let's go next to Abigail from San Francisco. Abigail, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
I really responded to the Dr. Tannen talking about the differences between men and women. And what was interesting was that I was raised without any sisters, but lots of brothers. And that I tend to be much more silent about feelings and stuff than a lot of my contemporary women friends. And I also have the big admonishment not to gossip at all. And just now I'm reflecting, I went through a period in my adolescence where I took a 1 year vow of silence. And that was really interesting, you know. I just sort of stood back and watched how people communicate and also how I could communicate nonverbally.
Yeah, you know, it's so important to keep in mind that some people are comfortable with more talk, some with less talk, some with different kinds of talk. And something that came up in this book that didn't with any other, and perhaps I just was missing it in other contexts, is the introvert-extrovert distinction. So for some people who lose energy to people versus people who gain energy from people, that's going to make a really big difference in how many friends you have, how much time you want to spend, and how much time you want to spend talking, and about what.
And I imagine that changes over someone's lifespan as well.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said I imagine that changes over someone's lifespan as well.
Yeah. Helen Fisher is someone who's written a lot about relationships as well, an anthropologist. She points out that there's a difference, that the introvert-extrovert distinction and the outgoing-reticent distinction are actually two different things. So you can be an introvert and outgoing, but you're still losing energy to people. And you can be an extrovert and reticent, but you still are gaining energy. energy from people. But yeah, I mean, all these things can change over time, and in different stages of your life too. You know, if you're home with small kids and you're working, you may not have time for friends. When your kids leave home, maybe you rediscover some of those friends.
And we have an email to that point from Marisol, who says, as I get older, I find it more difficult to make close friends and feel that I'm losing touch with many of my friends from my childhood. Is it more difficult to make friends as adults? And if so, why?
Very interesting. I heard from people in particular who moved as they got older. So it's not at all unusual to for people who have kids to move after they retired to be closer to the kids and the grandkids. Suddenly they're finding themselves in an environment where other people their age already have friends and aren't looking for new friends. So that's one thing that makes it harder. Also, if you're used to friends that have known you for a very long time, it's a little harder now because how do you fill them in on all that time? If you're retired and they don't know you in your professional guise, you can tell them about what you did before, but it doesn't have the same resonance as someone who lived through that with you.
Although I have
some of that, I think.
Although I have a close male friend who says that he sometimes feels like he needs new friends because all his old friends really know too much about him.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I have definitely heard that as well. One of the wonderful things about moving to a new city is you can start fresh.
So we've talked a lot about in this hour so far about how women use talk to make connection and also to demonstrate in the form of gossip sort of their social capital. Say more how women use talk to compete, how they jockey for position, with whether amongst other women or in a social hierarchy that is mixed gender.
Yeah, I think we all jockey for position to some extent. But again, it can vary both by personality and other factors. One woman made an interesting comment. She said that when in groups of men, she feels that you can kind of change your position. You can have more power at one point, and then you can kind of work to get more power at another point, where she feels that among women, you kind of have a position in that group, and that's it. It's hard to get out from under or change that. But I certainly encountered lots of examples of people feeling that other women were trying to one-up them when they would have been more comfortable with some sort of matching. Mm-hmm. So it's almost a stereotypical conversation where you say, something happened to me, and I say, oh, yeah, same thing happened to me. Oh, I know just how you feel. I know I would feel the same way. So it's a kind of matching. But sometimes I tell you about a problem, you tell me about your problem, and it's even worse. I can feel like you're trying to top me, or I can feel like you're taking the floor away, like you're saying, not I am just telling you the story because I understand, but enough about you. Let's talk about me. Mm-hmm. And some people do perceive it that way. With all these things, you never know whether what you perceive is what the person intended. But yeah, there a student had a very funny long conversation she told me about where she was complaining about finals, and she felt that whatever she came up with, her friend was topping her. You know, I have so many finals. Yeah, but at least your finals are all going to be over. Mine are going to go on forever. So it felt like she was trying to match and the other one was trying to top. Hmm. And then sometimes there's you can feel that if you tell about a problem, you kind of want your friend to tell you, oh, it's not so bad. And if she says, oh, yeah, that's terrible, you kind of feel like she just put you down. Hmm. I think there are a lot of cultural differences there, too. I quote a French anthropologist who wrote that she feels American friends are expected to say, oh, it wasn't so, you know, you didn't do the wrong thing. What you did was okay. I would have done the same thing. Whereas a French friend would say, oh, yeah, that was a pretty dumb thing to do. And she says, yeah, we would feel good. I knew you would set me straight.
So looking to friends, communication with friends for different types of validation. One to say, validating what I did versus one to say, validating that you're a true friend because you're really going to tell me about myself.
Yeah, and it's tricky because sometimes you kind of say something expecting a certain response and you get a different one. And you can feel hurt, you know, if you kind of... maybe if you tell a friend about you feel bad about something and you kind of want her to say it wasn't so bad and she says, yeah, that was terrible, you can feel like she's making you feel worse.
In the last few moments of the program, let's go to another caller. Again, the phone number 415-841-4134 if you want to join us to discuss the intricacies of communication and talk between women here in the last few minutes of our program with Deborah Tannen, author of the new book, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. Let's welcome Ruth Ann from El Cerrito.
Hi there. I wanted to corroborate with the previous caller said about how much harder it is to make secure friendships as I get older. But what I wanted to ask Deborah Tannen is if she had noticed in any of her studies, like she mentioned, the difference between how Asian women related as friends, if she's noted anything in the United States or even around the world about the difference between friendships with religion as the difference.
The comments I have about Asian are mostly about, there was that example I gave you of a Vietnamese American, but I have a bit from a Japanese perspective. So a woman that has written about Japanese American differences and a former student of mine, I asked her observations. She gave examples of how, for example, when her mother was ill in Japan, a close friend in Japan never really asked much about it. Again, that same thing I mentioned about the Vietnamese situation. You don't ask, but volunteered to do all kinds of things for her mother in the hospital that she might have wanted to do had she been there. Whereas her friend, her American friends, talked to her about it at length, about how she felt about it, and also like helped her shop for some things to get ready for the trip back to Japan. Her take on it was that Japanese friends will do far more for you and talk less about it. But she did comment that can be a heavy obligation because you realize that it's an obligation you have to find a way to repay. So that's just one example of Asian compared to American that I do write about.
So when it comes to religious differences that Ruth Ann was asking about, did you notice religious differences?
Cannot say that I did. No, it's not something I looked at.
Okay. And let's shift to women as in groups. Again, in your book, you talk about the sort of the double-edged sword of women in groups. They can marshal so much support and nurturing for each other, but then there's alliances and alignments that are shifting, and say more about that.
Yes, I have a whole chapter on women in groups. It is so fascinating. I give an example of my own about how comforting a group can be. Many, many years ago, my first marriage ended, and I could not bring myself to take my wedding ring off. I wanted the divorce. It wasn't that, but still, to go forth in the world without that wedding ring on just seemed too overwhelming. I happened to be visiting my sister. Her women's group was meeting. I didn't even know them, but I joined them, and somehow, you know, we talked about what was going on, and I mentioned that, and they encouraged me to take that ring off. And right there with the group surrounding me, I pulled the ring off and I threw it in the center of the circle, and they all applauded. And they enabled me to do something that I had found it hard to do. That feeling of support from that group of women was really powerful. So I have lots of examples like that. But when you have a group, there's always a risk of getting kicked out. So I had mentioned FOBLO, F-O-B-L-O, fear of being left out. I also coined the term FOGKO, F-O-G-K-O, fear of getting kicked out. And I heard terrible stories, mostly from middle school and high school, of groups of girls suddenly expelling one of their crowd, and terribly, terribly painful. And in fact, several of the women I talked to told me how guilty they still feel as adults for not having stood up for a friend who was kicked out of the group. And the reason is pretty easy to understand, because they fear that if they spoke up, they would be kicked out. And actually, one woman I spoke to said that happened to her when someone she was close to was threatened, you know, the group wanted to expel her, and she stuck up for her, and so they kicked her out too. It's one of the most painful stories that I heard of groups expelling one of their members. And even if you're not actually kicked out, there's still, anytime you have groups of people, there are shifting alignments. So if you, certain things have people have in common, they can be kind of connected, and others can feel left out. And as I mentioned, feeling left out is one of the liabilities, I would say, of girls and women's friendships. And that, too, traces to kids. I encountered numerous examples of how creative kids could be, little ones, at expelling or keeping out the ones that they don't like. And if you think it, well, they're telling secrets, you can kind of understand. You don't want somebody there that you don't want to share your secrets with. But sometimes, the funniest line I heard, this was by Amy Sheldon, a linguist who studied preschoolers, and she heard a little girl trying to keep another girl that she didn't like out of the group play. They were playing house. So she said to this little girl, well, you can be the baby brother, but you aren't born yet. Pretty creative, don't you think?
Yeah. So in the last moments or so of the program, I wanted to just ask you, what kinds of additional questions or new questions has your research at this point led you to? What's next on the horizon that you'd like to unpack from trying to better understand how women communicate with each other?
Well, I really do feel like the social media, that really is the horizon. It is getting so pervasive in women's friendships and in all our relationships. That's really the challenge, to understand how social media are both enhancing but also challenging these close relationships.
And so how can people find out about your book?
Well, it should be in every bookstore. And certainly you can get it off my website or Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. Or I think the best would be to go to the indie bookstores, though.
Great. And I hear that we missed you here in San Francisco. We just missed you here in the Bay Area, unfortunately.
You did. I just came back last night. But I think the bookstores all still have it.
I'm sure they do. Well, I want to thank you, Deborah Tan, a New York Times bestselling author and Georgetown linguist, and congratulate you on your latest book, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Same here. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join my co-host Ethan Elkind next Monday as we peer into the San Francisco's debate about creating a safe injection site. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week. Thank you.